Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. By this point, most of us have seen the National Geographic cover from June of 2018 that shows a single plastic bag at large-scale perspective looking precariously like an iceberg floating with 10% above the water and 90% looming dangerously below the surface. Planet or plastic? The issue is titled. It detailed that 18 billion pounds of plastic is dumped into the oceans each year. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, as they mention. The cover became iconic as soon as it hit print, like the Afghan girl photo or the redwood tree that expansively reached out of the covered Nat Geo yellow frame, or maybe even the gorilla holding the camera, seemingly shooting back at the photographer. Sometimes their photos are a sign of the times, a single image that can act as a zeitgeist, as where we're at. A call to action worth 1,000 words. As you read through this plastic issue, the stats are jaw-dropping. It's disgusting. It actually hurts reading them. Bringing that to my home court, it's difficult for me not to take it personally when I witness folks at my kids' sporting games or when traveling, when you see an educated, well-to-do person that is too busy in their day-to-day or on their mobile phones to realize that they've just dumped a single-use plastic bottle into the trash instead of the recycling bin that sits immediately right next to it. Believe it or not, it's these simple things that matter. Truth is, we need better solutions for making more good-intentioned people more aware of these situations and of the impact of their actions. We, in fact, are the agents of change. Well, it seems Nat Geo agrees. They've partnered with Sky Media, from the UK on Sky Ocean Ventures to invest in businesses that can help solve the ocean plastic crisis. The initiative is called the Ocean Plastic Innovation Challenge, and it's designed to create a global community of problem solvers, innovators, scientists, researchers, storytellers, and other creative minds who are passionate about bringing their ideas to life in order to stem the tide of plastic pollution. They will be contributing scientific expertise, grant and media muscle, and $10 million to help Sky Ocean Ventures identify and champion promising projects and technologies. The photos of the seahorse clutching onto the plastic Q-tip in that Nat Geo issue may say it all. This is on us. We can do better. We must do better. And what we do, even you and me, what we do, it matters. People are always watching. So even if it's the small acts of picking up the plastic bottles and recycling them, maybe even pulling them out of the trash as your friends and neighbors, don't take the time to put it in the right receptacle or bring your own grocery bags or even holding your purveyors and brands accountable for their packaging, it matters. Our kids are watching and they have to care about this stuff. So should we. Today, we welcome a guest who is part of an organization with a dog in this fight for solutions of change. A leader who has been fighting for cleaner oceans and responsible management for decades. Today, we welcome Teresa Ish of the Walton Family Foundation. Hey, Teresa, welcome.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. I am looking forward to this conversation. We had a chance to catch up a few weeks ago. Let me do this. I'm going to read you a bit more of your bio, and then we'll jump into some of the conversation. Teresa Ish manages grants for the environmental program that leverages the power of the supply chain to advocate for more sustainable fisheries. Before joining the foundation, Teresa was the seafood project manager for the corporate partnerships program at the Environmental Defense Fund, and she worked with leading seafood buyers to develop and implement sustainable seafood purchasing policies. During her tenure at the EDF, she played an instrumental role in merging the organization's seafood buyers' work and extensive experience in the fisheries policy arena. Prior to joining EDF, she worked at Fishwise, or excuse me, co-founded Fishwise, and served as the director of science. So Teresa, please, if you would, can you tell us about the work you're doing with the Walton Family Foundation?
Sure. The work that we do at the foundation is really focused on identifying solutions to big environmental problems that produce both environmental wins and positively impact the people who depend on the resource. And so in the case of our fisheries and oceans work, we believe that good fisheries management and sustainable fisheries will benefit fishermen, seafood businesses, as well as consumers who eat and depend on seafood for their food and nutrition.
It's a systems approach to this, right? We're all part of this system. We got to look out for each other.
Definitely. And I think what's really exciting about the work that I do, which is partnering with NGOs that work with the corporate sector and the seafood industry, is the fact that the seafood industry now recognizes that they are reliant on a healthy ocean and healthy fish stocks for their business, and that they share in the responsibility for helping us achieve well-managed, sustainable fisheries around the world.
Mm-hmm. So we did have a chance to meet in March at the Seafood Expo North America, the SENA Expo, which is the second largest seafood show in the world. And I wanted to mention that you were nice enough to invite me on a walking tour visiting some of the action-oriented projects that you've been working involved. So I wanted to just kind of walk through some of these and let you tell our audience a bit more of that. I found it fascinating to hear from these individuals, and I think it'd be good to talk more about that. So we first met with Casey Marion, the Director of Sustainable Initiatives for Quality Management at Florida-based SeaBest. Casey shared that with some of their systems, they've introduced a better understanding to sophisticated supply chains and global fisheries. So what got you interested in their systems thinking approach that they've introduced, and how do you see this being transformative to global fisheries?
SeaBest and the work that Casey does wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago or 15 years ago. The commitments that retailers have made to source sustainable seafood really jump-started the engagement of suppliers like Casey and his company in thinking about their active engagement in improving fisheries. And over the years, we've seen that move from sort of just trying to provide their customers with more sustainable fish to really investing their own money into improving the health of fisheries. And the fishery that Casey was featuring was a spiny lobster fishery that had all kinds of management problems. It was overfished. There were labor issues with the fishermen. Lobster fishing, dive fishing, can be very dangerous, and so there were problems with divers getting bent and having other sort of health complications from this fishery. And his company, as well as other companies and governments and NGOs in the region, have invested a lot of money in improving the management, improving the safety, and essentially putting their own resources into helping to make this fishery sustainable in the long term. And it's really not just an altruistic approach. I mean, I think certainly they look at themselves as being good corporate citizens, but this also has direct impact on their bottom line. They source from those fisheries. Those fisheries are an important part of the products that they supply to their customers, and their customers are asking for more sustainable products. And so they really have both the push out from the sources they're buying to incentivize them to better engage in reforms, but also the push down from their customers to make sure that they're supplying products that meet their sustainability requirements.
It was interesting because we obviously talked a lot about the best practices. I mean, it makes pragmatic business sense to not overfish your fishery, lose what you have, and not have something for tomorrow, and there's no crop, and not being involved in treating in the ecological systems. I mean, that makes all business sense. But one of the questions I asked, and I think you gave a great answer to it when we were at that booth, was regarding labor issues and fisheries, especially global fisheries, are notorious, or I guess maybe are typifying some of the labor issues around slave labor, around just poor conditions, people being out at sea for months at a time, and no one looking out for that. So what are we doing about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the labor issues are interesting because a lot of people don't realize that they're often rooted first in environmental degradation. As fishing boats overfish, or as nearshore fisheries are overfished, fishing vessels have to go farther and farther and farther out to sea to catch fish. And this makes it cost ineffective to bring crews back, and then encourages practices that require keeping your crews on your fishing vessels for a long period of time, participating in transshipment, which is where you move the fish from the boat that caught it to the boat that drives it back to shore to dock. And that means the crew doesn't come ashore. So a lot of these labor issues that we're seeing in fisheries are coming from the fact that there are fewer fish to catch. It's harder and more expensive for the companies to actually fish profitably. And where do you cut costs? Then you cut them with your labor costs. And that leads to unscrupulous labor brokers and really abysmal working conditions for the people who work on some of these fishing boats. And then I think that's also exacerbated by the fact that we as consumers, frankly, don't pay the full value of our fish and our natural resources. And so we're really trying to find this balance of how to get people to continue to be able to afford to eat fish because it is such a healthy food, and also ensure that there is equity in the supply chain. And that's something that we as a foundation, as well as our NGO partners and even our business partners, have not figured out how to ensure equity on both the consumer end and the production end. And I think it's one of the real challenges ahead of us for food production. And I don't think that's limited to fisheries, but I start to get a little bit out of my expertise when we look at other food sectors.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, just even as consumers, right? We look at these things, and many of the food categories we eat, specifically terrestrial meat, everything is farmed. Everything is nothing to do with, you know, ecological systems. The fact that fisheries, that 50% can still come from open-caught fisheries, is a natural resource that we have to look at differently. And the fact, as you said, how they're interrelated to some of these labor issues or these ecological issues is a interesting equation for people to take into account when they're buying better food.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's really hopeful, and that part of what brings me to this work, is that I do think that the challenges of overfishing are challenges that can be solved. We have seen fisheries recover when appropriate management, science-based management, is put into place, and the potential for a healthy, thriving, profitable fishing sector is something that is achievable and tangible. And it does require shifts in how businesses operate. It also requires shifts in how governments manage their fisheries and treat their resources. But it is something that's solvable, and I think that that's one of the nice, exciting things about this work and this food system is that you can see a path forward to a future where we have sustainable fisheries.
All right, let's continue our tour through the Boston Convention Center, which, by the way, you're quite nimble. I had the difficulty keeping up behind you with all, just swimming upstream with all those people. It was challenging. So we then moved a little further south and headed down to the Yucatan, and we chatted with Mauricio Orellana, I think I'm saying it right, about the octopus catch. And it was interesting because he described our approach to proactively engaging a community in sustainable open-caught fishery. Can you tell us more about why this Mexican fishery is a good example of future responsible fishery programs?
Yeah, this fishery is exciting because it is a very high-volume fishery. Mexico is the third largest exporter of octopus in the world, and it's comprised primarily of small-scale fishermen and community-based fishermen. And so this creates massive opportunities for helping to deliver sustainability messaging, awareness, and engagement at a very local level. It also creates some real challenges because there is a very large number of fishermen whose behaviors we need to change and whose engagement with the management of that fishery needs to change over time. But I think what's especially exciting about the work in Mexico is I think when people tend to think about sustainability, they think of it as sort of a U.S.-Europe issue. And Mauricio and his company come into play both because they exported to the U.S. and they really feel, or they do export to the U.S., and they feel the need to deliver their sustainability, the sustainable products to their customers in the U.S. But where that work has come in the last couple of years is Mauricio is really thinking about how he works in Mexican fisheries for Mexican consumers as well as for international consumers, and what it means for his country as a fishing nation. And I think that integration of the sustainability work, not just for markets who will pay more or who have a higher expectation of sustainability, but as something that he needs to embark on as a Mexican company who sources from Mexican fisheries. And that shift in thinking has been really exciting and something that we're seeing happen not just in Mexico, but in a number of places where our initial expectation for engagement in sustainability was low. Places like Japan, which now a number of the buyers there have sustainability commitments. The country just passed a fisheries reform law. A number of fisheries are starting to participate in these same sorts of improvement projects, like the one that Mauricio is working on in Mexico. We're seeing this happen in Brazil, in Chile, in Peru, in Korea. And so a lot of new markets and new producing countries are excited about the ability of better managed fisheries to deliver value to their people, to their supply chains, to the companies operating in those countries.
One of the questions that came up when we were there was the discussion of intellect of octopus. I think we even mentioned the book, The Soul of the Octopus. And someone asked the concern about octopus being a sentient being. And, well, of course they are. And, you know, it's a bit like asking a pig farmer, how did he like his bacon, though? You know, it's obviously the less meat or less protein and the better of it and the better off we are. But in ocean health and fisheries, it shouldn't really be any different, right? The more we appreciate these animals coming from the sea, and the more that we respect that how important the stable oceans are to our personal health, the better off we are. So what has your foundation done to encourage awareness of consumers to the values of seafood that they eat?
Our work with consumers has primarily come through an expectation that the retailers and the restaurants where they buy fish educate them on why sustainability matters. When this work launched in 1997, the sustainable seafood movement, a lot of the effort was focused on consumers. And, you know, this was a different time of no podcasts and no social media. And it was very challenging to translate individual consumer action to change on the water. And that work changed about 5 to 10 years in, to really think about where are the pinch points in this system, where can we influence the fewest actors to make the biggest change, and that is really where the focus on the supply chain came in. There are 8 billion consumers of seafood in the world, and there are hundreds of millions of fishermen in the world, and trying to change those behaviors has been really difficult. And so we really have focused on the suppliers, the retailers, to make those changes as part of their brand, as part of their own strategy, and then to use their relationship they have with their customers to help people understand why these are important changes. I think today, where we have social media influencers and other ways to get out information at scale, I think we have new opportunities to talk to people about where their fish comes from and what it means to be sustainable and why it's important, not just for the environment, but for them as people who love to eat seafood. Because if you love to eat fish, the first thing you should be concerned about is whether or not they're going to be fish to eat. And I think that investment and engagement of someone who really loves to eat seafood in ensuring that it comes from a sustainable source is an important relationship to start reinforcing. And we're just now starting to rethink how we better engage consumers and better use food influencers to help get this message out to the people who eat seafood.
I'm sure, yeah, we have to make sure we have more fish to eat and they're not filled with microplastics, and we've got many other systems problems. To that point, yeah, it is a systems discussion, and I'm sure your background at Fishwise, which is really this multi-stakeholder initiative instance, bringing in all those different players so you can find some harmony, find some compliance and background, but also to instigate and incentivize those stakeholders to partake, must be a valuable asset for you as you look at these things through your foundation now.
Yeah, and I think what was really interesting when Fishwise was started, and I think highly relevant and makes me very appreciative to be on this podcast, is that when people talked about food systems, fisheries were often not included in that discussion. Seafood was often not included in that discussion. And when we started Fishwise, the surprise or the motivation to do that was there was a natural food store in our town that where you could get tons of information on the produce you're buying, all the meat that you're buying, and the fish was just fish in the counter. And we really wanted to start Fishwise to help people better understand where their fish came from and do that in a way that wasn't scary or wasn't punitive in telling you don't buy certain things, but thinking that if people had better information, they would make better decisions. And working with the buyers as the ones who actually decided what went into the case to help them share that information and share that decision. And that required work not just with the private sector and not just with retailers, but their supply chains, with other NGOs that did assessments of the sustainability of seafood, and with organizations that did on-the-ground work to actually improve fisheries. And so it really was built with this collaborative spirit to it as an organization, and really meant to fill in that gap of how people thought about food systems and start to think about seafood as part of the broader sustainable food system and sustainable food landscape.
It is fascinating. I struggle with that as well. I think mostly from my proximity, being a New Englander, growing up on an orchard and in dairy country, but also going to visit my grandparents on the Cape or down by Buzzards Bay, I was immersed to both. But I do listen to all, you know, many experts in different space, and it is either or, it's soil health or ocean health. But when listening to the language, the passion, the vision, and how this all comes together with better food that affects the consumer, we are speaking that similar language. There is an opportunity to create that same kind of inertia and momentum behind both movements together.
Well, and they're extremely interconnected as well. I mean, an important piece of soil health is maintaining the nutrients in the soil, ensuring they're not running off into the rivers. Everything from the rivers runs into the ocean. You open this show with a discussion around ocean plastics, but in some ways that's almost kind of a misnomer because it's not like the plastics originate from ocean-based activities. They originate from the activities that we take on in land. If you look at aquaculture and where all the feed for those aquaculture fish are coming from, a large volume of that comes from agriculture that is made into essentially livestock feed, but for fish, with other ingredients to meet the nutritional needs of fish. But there's that land-sea connection again. And I think that it is a food system because it incorporates both land impacts and ocean impacts, and those two are intricately related.
Yeah, it's true. We have looked at the floating plastic islands, and I've had this discussion with some friends, as just being icing on the cake of enlightenment towards food, because exactly to your point, it is so connected of the bad practices we take, and much of the shortcuts in terrestrial production are leading to many of the problems with 70% of our Earth's surface, which is obviously ocean coverage. But hey, let's return back to our tour of the SENA, the Seafood Expo, because I wanted to mention we also had a chance to then explore more of my native waters here in New England, and we chatted with Richard Stavis from the iconic brand of Stavis Seafood. We connected with Luke Holden from Luke's Lobsters, Dick Jones of Ocean Outcomes, and Sean Murphy of Sustainable Fisheries Partnership. And this meeting focused on trends in fisheries and seafood that are meshing with modern consumer interest, product traceability and transparency, differentiation by location, and an approach to harvest or catch all of that seafood with that nomenclature or that provenance associated to it. So effectively decommoditizing our seafood as a whole with a lunch, which is interesting to your point earlier, we put all seafood, everything coming from the sea, as this $130 billion commodity element. So is this a trend of knowing where your seafood is coming from and appreciating the approach used and bringing it to market, whether that's aquaculture or open catch? Is it just in its infancy? Are we moving in this direction?
I think it's a trend, and I think it's a trend that is following how people look at their other food choices as well. And I think all of this is coinciding with this huge bloom of technology that actually allows the verification and the transparency and the storytelling that people are looking for. You know, it's really interesting when we think about decommoditizing seafood, because you're right. Like, we don't eat a land food sandwich, yet people very frequently order seafood sandwiches. And so there is this sort of lumping that happens with fish. And I think that the relationship to the fish that we eat comes from appreciating it, knowing about it, and that all ties into the sustainability issues. You know, we struggle at the foundation with the work that we do around really taking these opportunities around these stories of provenance and connecting people to their food, and the fact that there is industrial production of fish. And frankly, a lot of people may be surprised that many of those industrial fisheries are actually quite well managed, because there are fewer people that you have to work with, and they have a more consolidated and more data-rich environment in which they work, so that you can manage those fisheries with data. And so the provenance issue is, I think, really important for highlighting good producers and getting people to understand the potential for sustainability, as well as allowing people to demonstrate that they value these stories and this sustainability. But at the same time, we can't ignore the commodity seafood, the bulk of the seafood that really feeds the country and many people around the world, and that can be good too. It always, I think, surprises people that McDonald's in the U.S. and Europe sells Marine Stewardship Council certified Filet-O-Fish. So you're not getting necessarily the sort of connection to the fishermen from products like that, but you can still support sustainability at a very large scale. And I think we need both in our system, because we need to be able to get sustainable fish to all types of consumers, and we need all types of fisheries to be able to be effectively managed and to deliver benefits to both the small-scale fishermen and the large-scale fisheries that provide large volumes of seafood.
It is interesting, because we have seen in the terrestrial model, probably just because it is so broken, the interest in the local food movement. And the local food movement obviously is always penalized in the fact it has no economies of scale until it develops into a regional ecosystem. And I think it's fascinating, because to your point, when you get to the conventional scale or industrial scale of conventional, it is a significantly worse infrastructure than many of our global fisheries, which are better managed and have been at least strategically planned in a different way. So, well, we're all coming to the middle in some way, right? And it's got to be awareness, appreciation. And again, I think much of this, as we've talked about, comes down to us and us being these agents of change. Now, Teresa, if you could share with our listening audience a bit more about the Walton Family Foundation 2020 Environment Strategic Plan.
Yeah, excited to. Our strategy right now is really focused on improving and engaging with fisheries management in five major seafood producing countries: the U.S., Indonesia, Mexico, Chile, and Peru. And we recognize that those countries depend on three very large markets as importers, as trading partners for their seafood. So on the market side, which is the part that I work on, we're looking at seafood consumption and imports in Japan, the U.S., and Spain as a major gateway to the European market. And we've really focused on how we can link up the demand for sustainability and the power that the seafood industry has with the management reforms and the engagement with government and the work with small-scale and large-scale fishermen in these producing countries to generate a healthier seafood sector. That means improvements on the water, improvements in management, improvements in fisheries sustainability, but also thinking about the role of those supply chains and helping to incentivize and support and engage with those governments and those fisheries and making themselves more sustainable. And so there is not an actor within that group that doesn't hold some sort of responsibility in helping to improve the sustainability of our fisheries. And we chose these five countries not because they're the only places that it's important to work, but because we believe that the types of fisheries they fish, the volumes of fisheries that they produce, they can really serve as a bellwether to what the rest of the world can do. And we want to use these countries as a way to understand how we can actually fix global fisheries and how we can engage fisheries around the world to become more sustainable.
And it's interesting because all of those were represented at the Seafood Exchange or the Expo. It was it is a vast representation. Between that and Brussels, you get a chance to meet, I'm sure, these major actors across the board. What differences have you seen with working with those globally diverse fisheries? Is there something that stands out in your mind of both commonality and difference?
Yeah, I think the commonality is really some of the challenges in how we support fishermen themselves and the fishing communities as we transition to sustainability. You know, in the U.S., where we have some very well-managed fisheries, some of the fishermen are still struggling to ensure that they have viable livelihoods. In Indonesia, it's no different. The small-scale fishing communities are closer to the resource. They really rely on sustainable fishing, yet they are sustainable fisheries. Yet they have less power as individuals to influence how that fishery is managed. And so there are these tensions between the people who are often closest to the resource are also potentially the most at risk for overfishing, but collectively could do the most to end overfishing. And so working through those dynamics is something that's really interesting. I think the other commonality across the board is the shared responsibility of both the seafood industry and the government to ensure that the resources are well managed. And that when we see the seafood industry advocate for the same conservation and sustainable management that conservation groups and NGOs and the fishermen are advocating for, we're in a better position for the governments to take action and hold their responsibility of managing this collective resource. And then I think finally the really fascinating commonality is just how global the seafood trade is. We've been doing our work in Chile for on working with domestic fisheries there, and a lot of the sea urchin caught there goes to Japan. The U.S., a lot of our pollock goes both to Japan and consumed in the U.S. and goes to Europe. And then Mexico consumes a lot of fish, exports a lot of fish, but then imports a lot of fish from other countries. And so all of these places we're working have very complicated relationships with their own domestic fisheries and their supply chains, and what people in those countries eat. It truly is a global market for seafood. And again, that creates tremendous opportunities around working collaboratively and sort of fixing global fisheries, but also real challenges in the fact that the leverage point in terms of who's buying what is not always clear, and it can be difficult to really trace where your fish comes from so that you can engage in how that fishery is managed.
To live in a world where people can accomplish anything when they have opportunity and encouragement is the vision of the Walton Family Foundation. And your mission statement says that we are a family-led foundation that tackles tough social and environmental problems with urgency and a long-term approach to create access to opportunity for people and community. So, Teresa, for my last question, I wanted to know, I understand that along with the focus on environmental concerns, which you're working on in oceans, your foundation also invests significantly into K-12 educational programs and also in the home regions of the family you represent. Have you worked on any projects that integrate all areas that have broken down the silos, maybe a K-12 educational program focused on regenerative ocean farming, for instance?
We have not invested in projects directly together, but you definitely see commonalities in how the foundation works across its programs. And one is really looking for those wins that both benefit people and benefit the system in which we're working in, and empowering people and to make the decisions they need and to make the changes they need that are positive for themselves and, again, the system that they're trying to influence. So, you know, in our K-12 education, it's empowering parents to find schools for their kids that meet their needs. In the case of our environment program, it's working with farmers and fishermen and the people close to the resource to identify how better management, whether it's of their croplands or of their water resources or of their fisheries, how finding that better management supports their goals and benefits them as well as the environment. And so this effort to really think about how we engage and how we think about maximizing the value, not the monetary value, but the value overall of the impacts we're trying to achieve is something that's shared. The other thing that's shared between the different programs and the foundation is this long-term view. I think in all of our programs, we recognize that we are trying to change systems, and that doesn't mean a sort of three-year quick win type of investment where we disappear. When we work in communities, and it, regardless of sector, we spend a lot of time both being really thoughtful in where we work, but also really ensuring that we are investing in a way that helps build the durability of the work that we do, so that when it is time for the foundation to exit into other projects, that work doesn't just disappear. It's embedded into the community where we worked or into the country or the fishery where we've done our work. And those values are what's shared between the different programs in the foundation, even if our work does not directly intersect.
That's fantastic work. Where can our listening audience learn more about what you're doing within Oceans and what the other programs are that the foundation has available?
So to learn more about the foundation, you can visit www.waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And on that site, you can learn more about our work in all three different programs, K-12 Ed, Environment, and our home region work in Northwest Arkansas. You can also get information about some of our grantees and the work that they're doing, get really wonderful stories about what some of our investments have produced in the communities, more importantly, where we work. And this can range from a school in Washington, D.C., to fishermen at the very southern tip of the Chilean coast. And so we really try to represent the breadth and the diversity of the types of projects that we fund, all still very much focused on those values that I talked about that the program share, but also in the places where our foundation is focusing its work.
Well, I'll just say that I learned a great deal from today's conversation. I'm sure our listening audience did as well. I learned a great deal in our walking tour of the Seafood Expo North American conference that happened a few weeks ago. So, Teresa Ish, I appreciate you taking the time, and I'll just say until next time.
Yeah, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.